Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gina Bellaria, former Litton Program Director here at the Commonwealth Club and currently Communications Manager at California Forward and lecturer at San Francisco State. It is my pleasure tonight to introduce Josh Bearer, linguist, journalist, and blogger of the site Nomad Out of Time. Josh has utilized his journalistic skills in many areas in many corners of the world. He's worked as a translator for the Bedouin in Israel, served as a newspaper editor in Yemen, an antiquarian book cataloger in Los Angeles, and producing documentaries for Johnson & Johnson. His work has been published in the Jewish Daily Forward, Yemen Today, and the Yemen Times. Josh speaks Arabic, Turkish, and Hebrew, and studies Persian and Uzbek. He's lived in Istanbul, Sana'a, Jerusalem, and Amman. It was Yemen that drew Josh and his partner, Rachel, because of their desire to explore non-Western Jewish cultures. He's currently getting his master's in Central Eurasian Studies at the University of Indiana, and I'd like you to please welcome Josh Bearer.
Thank you very much. Can you guys hear me at the back? Wonderful. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club and Jimena for having me here. I'm really excited to be here. Hopefully, this will be moderately interesting for you. I'd like to talk about the last Jews of Yemen, a little bit about the history of the Jews in Yemen, and how it came to be that there were fewer than 400 Jews left in the country. Now, I first went to Yemen in 2007. I had just graduated with a degree in Arabic, and I went there to simply study more, to study Islamic law, grammar, poetry, literature. And when I was there, I was introduced to this history of the Jewish presence in Yemen. And growing up in America, even as an Ashkenazi Jew, I had been aware of the fact that there was this rich cultural history in the Arab world, but it was something of the past. It was an era that had gone. And meeting Jews and seeing Jewish life in Yemen really put the hook in me. And when I returned from Yemen, I started to learn and read everything I could find about the history of the Jews in Yemen. And I ended up in Israel. And after a year in Israel, I went back to Yemen with my partner, Rachel. And we spent 3 months in the last community of Jews in Yemen documenting their lives. And I was collecting folklore and she was taking photographs. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the history of the community. And then I'll talk about the events that led to their emigration. And finally, where we find ourselves today. Now, we can divide the periods of Jewish life in Yemen into four periods. The Jews went to Yemen around 2,500 years ago, sent there by, they say, King Solomon as traders. Now, this makes them the oldest remaining Jewish, continually inhabited indigenous Jewish community in the Middle East, and therefore the world. We'll call the ancient period from their arrival 500 years before the Common Era to the Islamic conquest in the year 630. From the Islamic conquest until their emigration started, we can call that the medieval period. And then the waves of emigration that saw the vast majority of the community end up in Israel from 1880 to 1950. And then the era that we find ourselves in today from 1951 to the present. Now, not much is known about the history of the Jews in the ancient period. Suffice to say that in the at the time of the Islamic conquest, there were Jewish communities throughout the Arabian Peninsula, notably focused along the Hejaz region. They worked the trade routes that went from the Horn of Africa north into the Fertile Crescent, and Jewish communities existed throughout that region. But after the Islamic conquest, the so-called heartland of the Arabian Peninsula, what's today Saudi Arabia, within 200 or 300 years, the Jews that were living in that area had migrated or were pushed north into Iraq, Syria, and Egypt. The Jews in Yemen, however, a large percentage of them did convert to Islam, but they remained as a minority until the present day. Now, the majority of their communities were focused in small rural village hamlets in the mountains. About half the community lived in Sana'a, the capital, and that balance kind of existed, half the community in Sana'a and half in these rural villages out here on the tips of hilltops. Wow. For the majority of the existence in Yemen. Now, oftentimes in hamlets such as these, there would only be one extended family of Jews living amongst the Muslim community. This made contact and communication with all of Yemenite Jewry exceptionally difficult because they were so spread out and so hard to reach. Now, under Islamic rule, the Jews were known as dhimmi, and this is a word that's incredibly politicized and has all these different connotations and meanings today, and I'm not going to delve too deeply into that. Suffice to say that dhimmi refers to any non-Muslim minority living under Islamic law, and they were or under Islamic rule. And they were, of course, members of this community. Now, because of that status, there were certain restrictions placed upon them. For example, Jewish houses needed to be lower than Muslim houses, synagogues lower than mosques. If a Muslim were to meet a Jew in the street, the Jew would have to step into the muck and allow the Muslim to pass. The Jews were also prohibited from carrying any form of weapon, but most notably the traditional dagger that all Yemeni men wear as a it's just part of the traditional costume. It's traditionally worn on an embroidered belt, and Jews were also prohibited from wearing that particular style of belt. They had to tie their belts with rope. They were also required to ride side saddle, no horses, only donkeys. And most importantly, and this will come into play later on, Jewish orphans were taken from their families. Traditionally, they would be raised by extended family or the community. But under this particular decree, Jewish orphans were taken and put in Muslim families and raised as Muslims. Now, not all of these restrictions were in place at one time. Oftentimes, a ruler that was hostile towards the Jews would impose one of these restrictions only to be forgotten later, and then sometimes even centuries down the road, reenacted by another ruler who was, again, hostile towards the Jews. Now, the Jews worked around these restrictions. For example, the fact that Jewish houses needed to be lower than Muslim houses. Today, when you go to a house in the Jewish quarter, and the Jewish quarter of Sana'a still stands, it's just another neighborhood of the city now, when you open the door, you immediately go down a steep set of stairs, and what that did was gave a single-story house essentially a second story down below. You can see this is a photo that was taken 2 years ago in the village of Raida, and you can see the two Jewish guys. They're not wearing the traditional dagger, whereas their Muslim friend on the end is. So this restriction on carrying of the jambiya remains to this day. Now, in addition to those restrictions, they were also relegated to or excluded from certain professions. Usually the professions that Jews occupied in Yemen were professions that were considered unclean or otherwise undesirable by the majority population. So leather tanning and shoemaking, hand crafts such as carpentry and masonry, but it was the metalsmiths that the Jews in Yemen gave their artistic contribution to the world. Silversmith or silver jewelry from Yemen is unmatched in its quality. A historian of silver filigree can look at a piece from Britain, from Ukraine, from Yemen, and immediately know that this is the Yemeni work because its finery is unrivaled. Now, the Jewish silversmiths in Yemen kept their trade and their trade secrets, secret not only from the Muslim community, but even from each other. So what that created was a situation where Jewish families and tribes in Yemen had distinctive styles that were easily identifiable and unique to them. So today, there's a large silver market in Yemen. And with this gentleman, I actually started to learn about the history of the Jews in Yemen for the first time. We would sit and talk for a long time, and he'd tell me about the different communities and where they lived and the different styles of jewelry that they were known for. He can, as can any merchant in the silver market, look at a piece of jewelry and immediately tell you which family made it based on the designs and the filigree. So for this piece, for example, he would be saying that because of the geometric patterns in the designs, this is a Bedihi piece, whereas a Bosani piece would be identifiable by the more floral and organic forms in the filigree. Now, in the 19th century, a series of events came together that created a situation where the Jews of Yemen were ripe to leave. By the end of the 19th century, certain events had transpired that their emigration to Israel was a natural progression. So the rise of hostile government decrees, notably the Orphans Decree, which I mentioned, that was reenacted, And the dung gatherer's decree, which is kind of self-explanatory, Jews were required to gather the dung of animals in the street, as well as haul away the dead animals and dispose of them. Both of these were seen as incredibly humiliating and degrading decrees by the Jewish community, and coupled with the violence and the ease of travel restrictions lifted by the Ottoman Empire, the possibility of emigration suddenly became a physical political reality. So whereas before they simply accepted their lot and had no other option, with the opening of the Suez Canal and the ease of travel restrictions, suddenly emigration from Yemen became an actual reality, a potential reality. Now, more importantly, though, there was a messianic fervor that was ignited within the country in the second half of the 19th century that primed the community for emigration. They believed, they truly believed, that we were in the time of the Messiah. It was at our doorstep. Now, these were photos that were taken around the turn of the century in Sana'a. Now, these messianic movements arose and convinced the population that there were signs, there were identifiable signs in the world that we could follow, and indicated that the time of the Messiah was upon us. Both, all of these people originally told the people that they were simply messengers of the Messiah, but slowly, slowly, they made the claim that they were, in fact, the Messiah himself. And despite the fact that all of them proved to be false messiahs, this fervor was ignited. And when the Zionist movement arrived, the second Yehuda ben Salem, Shokol Kuhayel II, was by far the most influential of these figures. And he died in 1872. 8 years later, the Zionist movement arrives and convinces the Jews this was not a hard sell, that the ingathering of the exiles, when they heard that Jews from all over the world were congregating on Eretz Israel, this was seen as simply the next step in a very identifiable progression towards the Messianic Age. So what we have is, by the end of the 19th century, in 1880, the first wave of emigration from Yemen arrives in Palestine. Now, the first Jews actually walked up the Arabian Peninsula to Palestine. And when they arrived, they presented themselves to the Central Rabbinic Committee in Jerusalem, saying, "Here we are." Now, these guys had never seen a Yemenite Jew. They'd never seen a brown Jew. And so they doubted that they were even Jewish. They were brought before a special tribunal to examine their Judaism. And when one of them started reciting the Torah by heart, that convinced them. Now, as the desire to emigrate to Palestine ramped up among the Jews of Yemen, and this was a desire that was present in, they estimate that there were about 1,500 separate Jewish communities living throughout the country. This was a desire that was present in all of them. What happened was the Aden Jewish community, which was a little bit more well off than the Jews living in rural areas, they set up a special transit camp for Jews wishing to emigrate to Palestine. So they had a building like a dorm where Jews would arrive and wait for the next ship, and then they would go via the Suez Canal to Jaffa. Now, in this first era of emigration, roughly 16,000 Jews migrated, all on their own volition, all out of their own pocket. This migration was fueled not so much by fear, but certainly by the second-class citizen status that they had in Yemen, but it was more fueled by a true and genuine belief that for the Messiah to come, all of the Jews in the world must converge upon Israel. Now, as this emigration accelerated, the first wave, or the first immigrants in Palestine, would send communications back to their families in Yemen, and this only accelerated the process. Now, this is a Yemeni immigrant in one of the moshavim that are set up in the Galilee. I just love that picture, I'm sorry. Now, after the establishment of the State of Israel, as the State of Israel was ramping up at the end of World War II in the late 1940s, you see a simultaneous escalation of hostility among all the Arab governments towards their indigenous Jews, which Gina spoke a bit about. Now, in 1947, immediately preceding the creation of the State of Israel, there was a riot in Aden. 80 Jews were killed. Another 76 were injured. Scores of Jewish businesses and houses were burned. And this event was widely publicized throughout the community that was left in Yemen. And this crystallized their desire that not only should they emigrate, but it is a matter of self-preservation to do so. The Jewish Agency for Israel, which was the main arm orchestrating and still orchestrates today the ingathering of Jews to Israel, set up a secret arrangement between the leader of Yemen, Imam Yahya, and Alaska Airlines that allowed Alaska to fly more than 450 flights on a specially modified aircraft with larger fuel tanks because they couldn't stop anywhere during along the way, to fly 49,000 Jews over 2 years to Israel. This was an operation that was known in Hebrew as Mivtza Kanfei Nesherim, Operation on Wings of Eagles. This has been popularized in English as Operation Magic Carpet. Now, a special camp, a secondary camp in Aden, the camp that existed in the first wave was kind of reconstituted and enlarged. It was renamed Geulah, meaning redemption. Jews would be, the Jewish Agency actually purchased several buses and would bus out to the village, collect all the Jews that were there, and then ferry them back to Aden, where they would be put on planes and then taken to Israel. Many of them had never seen a plane and initially refused to get on until the Bible verse where that the name Operation Magic on Wings of Eagles comes from was quoted to them, saying, "I will take you to Zion on wings of eagles." And they said, "Okay." Now, this operation ended in 1950, the official last flight. There were still roughly 3,000 Jews, 1,000 to 3,000 Jews left in the country. There was a slow trickle out of people who were just late. They missed the bus, essentially, and showed up in Aden hoping to get on a flight. And the Jewish Agency, until 1962, was able to organize the extraction of those stragglers. But in 1962, the imamate fell, and the government or the country was plunged into civil war until 1969. At that point, the country was split into two Yemens, North Yemen and South Yemen. And from 1969, or from 1962 rather, until the mid to late 1980s, almost nothing is known about the Jewish life in Yemen. There was no communication with the communities, even by their own family in Israel. No emissaries or messengers were sent in, and in fact, non-Jewish American tourists that were recruited to give just messages saying, "How are you? You know, we're waiting for you," were in fact arrested as spies of Israel and put in jail. It was a diplomatic nightmare for the United States. And during that time, there was an intense propaganda campaign by the Yemeni government that Zionism is an evil movement, and we're okay to let you stay because we recognize that you're Yemeni and you're Jewish and you're not Zionists. And the last thing you want to be is Zionists because we know what happens to Zionists in Yemen. So this was drilled into their thinking for 30 years, close to 30 years. So when the doors finally opened after the fall of the Soviet Union, the reunification of Yemen, the Jewish Agency had a very difficult time persuading those people that their home should be in Israel. Now, at this point, a very interesting and unlikely element enters the mix, and that is the role of the Satmar Hasidim. It's an ultra-Orthodox, ultra-anti-Zionist Ashkenazi Jewish organization based in New York. And because they are so fiercely anti-Zionist, it's in their best interests, or it's in their interests, to preserve diaspora communities around the world. In the late 1980s, when the situation was starting to open up a little bit, an individual named Zion Ozeri was able to get his way in. He's an American born of Yemeni-Israeli parents, But because he has an American passport, he was able to get into the country. And he took two books of photographs of absolutely breathtaking work documenting the life of the Jews of Yemen in the 1980s. And at this point, the Jewish community was split between the village of Raida and then in the northern mountains scattered throughout villages, Wadi Amla, the Haran, several other villages. But we're talking fewer than 3,000 people. But he managed to get in and document the traditional way of life. Now, this was taken in Raida, and the guy in the front, in the foreground, he emigrated to Israel right as I was leaving Israel. We met kind of crossing paths. The guy in the back with the glasses is still in Raida, and I met him when I was there. Now, after the reunification of Yemen, an individual named Haim Tawil formed the International Coalition for the Revival of the Jews of Yemen, which was an aid organization, and he went into Yemen. He's, again, American, born of Israeli Yemenite parents. He went into Yemen with the help of the State Department and managed to convince a large percentage of the community, probably 70 to 80% of the community, to emigrate to Israel. And that happened in 1992 to 1995. Roughly 1,500 people left to Israel. They primarily settled in Rehovot, which there's a large Yemenite community in Rehovot. At this point, also, the Satmar and the Netzarei Karta, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the Netzarei Karta, they're the ones that march with the Palestinian flag, burning the Israeli flag. They're the most vocal anti-Zionist, ultra-Orthodox group, the tiny group, talking several hundred people, but they're very vocal. They go into Yemen to convince the Jews that their life is wonderful in Yemen. Don't go to Israel. They'll steal your children in Israel. They throw you out of the plane on the way there. I'm not joking. That's something they said. But by the end of 1998, roughly only 500 people remained in the country. At that point, those that stayed were given ample opportunity to leave, both by the Satmars to go to New York if they wanted to, and by the Jewish Agency to go to Israel if they wanted to. But they chose to stay in Yemen largely out of indifference. And I'll talk a lot about why they stayed. But it wasn't an urgency for them at that point. Now, the Satmars, as I mentioned, are fiercely anti-Zionist. And the Yemenis, for them, are seen as pure Jews, Jews that have lived as religious Jews, keeping all of the halachot, all of the laws, for their entire existence. They haven't been swayed by secular thinking or by all the draws and lures of the Western world and the modern world. They remain pure. If you read Satmar newspapers talking about their work in Yemen, they use this term of purity, of innocence, of a Judaism that's undiluted. So they bring books, materials, religious materials. And when I was in this village at that school, not only did I meet one of these individuals, you can see at the very top, the guy with the black hat is a Satmar emissary. Not only did I meet one, and I can tell you that meeting a black hat Hasidic Jew in the village in the mountains of northern Yemen is a kind of jarring, bizarre experience, but in addition to that, the Torahs that they use and the Siddurs, the prayer books that they use, I opened up the front cover and they were stamped Netzarei Karta, New York City. Now, the Yemenis that have agreed to go with the Satmars and live in New York and live in particularly Muncie, upstate New York, it's one of their enclaves, have reported essentially a captivity of sorts. They're not taught English. They're only taught Yiddish. They're completely financially dependent upon the Satmars. And what the fact is, and the fact that they don't learn English means that they're completely unable to integrate into the larger American society. They're completely dependent upon Satmars. I met a man in Israel, a Yemenite man from Raida, who had lived in New York for 10 years and did perfect fluent Yiddish, not a single word of English. And this is a directed campaign by the Satmars. Now, one of the things he said is they're good Jews and they help. but at the same time, he had no options. Now, this is the school in Raida. This was taken about 3 years ago. A few of these kids are now in New York. The teacher is now in Israel. These are photos inside the school. Yemenite Jewry retains some very interesting aspects that, with the exception of the Kurdish Jews, were lost to the rest of global Jewish culture. For example, it was tradition that after a verse of the Torah was read on the Sabbath, a member of the community would echo that verse, would read it again, but this time in Aramaic. This is a holdover for when Hebrew stopped being the language of the vernacular and Aramaic was what Jews spoke, so someone would read the translation so the community that didn't speak Hebrew could understand. Now, this is still present in Yemen, and tradition states that it's a boy under 13 that reads the Aramaic. So after someone reads the Torah, they pause after every verse, and a kid, sometimes no older than 7 years old, will echo it in perfect Aramaic. It put my Judaism to shame, I'll tell you. Now, in the late 90s and early 21st century, a rebellion in the north by Houthi rebels. The thing you have to understand about Yemeni politics is the government really, when you say the Yemeni government, we're talking about the capital and a narrow strip of land outside the capital, because once you extend past the military checkpoints that surround the capital, you're really under the control of the tribes. And central government has very little sway at that point. Now, one of these tribes, the Al-Houthi, led by a man named Abdul Malik Al-Houthi and his brother, started an insurrection in the north of the country focused around the city of Saada. Now, it so happened that of the two remaining Jewish settlements in Yemen, in Raida and in Saada, one of them was about 45 kilometers, but under the rebels' jurisdiction. And one day, they came to the Jews' houses and said, essentially, you have 2 weeks to get out. And that's that. The Jews brought their protest to the government, and the government actually brought them out, evacuated them, took them to Sana'a, and gave them houses in a protected compound with guards at all the gates, a monthly stipend, food, and essentially all the basic staples of life are provided for them. They're not living lavishly. They're not making tons of money from the government, but they do have a monthly salary. And as a result, they are extremely loyal to this government, the Jews from Saada that moved to, that are now in Sana'a. And it was with this community that I did most of my research. At the time that I was there, the Houthis had progressed so far south that Raida was under their jurisdiction as well, or under threat of their jurisdiction. And so as a precautionary measure, the government cut off all foreign travel to that part of Yemen. So us as foreigners were prohibited from going to Raida the second time I was there. Now, there currently exists 67. There were 65 at the time, two were born. 67 Jews in the capital. Like I said, living in this protected compound. And their day basically consists of chewing gut, which is a mild narcotic. Yemen is an interesting country because it's an example of a society that's probably 90% addicted to a narcotic, and the effects are seen throughout the country. I mean, this country literally shuts down at 1 o'clock so people can all go home and sit around and chew gut for the next 6 hours. So the Jews obviously have very little to do, so they chew gut all day. Now, this is the rabbi. He's the our main contact in the community. He's the one that kind of got us in, and he was our closest friend. The middle guy, the one reading the paper. On his sides are his father and his uncle, neither of whom read Arabic script. They're both obvious. All three of them are obviously native Arabic speakers, but the older generation learned to write the Arabic language in Hebrew characters, known as Judeo-Arabic. So only the rabbi knows Arabic writing, so he's at this in this photograph reading news of the war in Saada, their former home, to his father and uncle. Now, Jewish life at this point is focused around the rabbi. He's the linchpin of the community. He's the one that knows the laws of kosher slaughter. He's the one that knows the laws of circumcision. All the legal and ritual aspects that are required for a Jewish community to survive depend upon him. This photograph was taken during the holiday of Simchat Torah, which commemorates the completion of the Torah. It's a festive holiday, and at that time, I remember he came into the living room with like a Santa Claus sack full of candy for all the kids, and on the day of, he passed it all out, and it was a festive occasion. His living room is the synagogue. For reading the Torah, they kind of cart out a little podium, and the you can barely see a little bit of blue behind the boy's head. That's their Torah. Now, their Torah, like them, is a refugee. It's more than 300 years old, and it survived countless wars. And traditionally, it would be held in a case that kind of was put vertically and then opened like a sandwich. But in the haste to flee, they didn't take their case with them and instead just wrapped it in a series of tarps and brought it out. Now, this is again on that same holiday. Now, in 2009, there was an event in the village of Reda that kind of crystallized and put the nails in the coffin of the last Jews of Yemen, as far as I'm concerned. The murder of Moshe Nahari. Now, this is Moshe Nahari, and on December 11th, 2009, he was at the market in his village in Reda. And he was called upon to convert. This man, he's a mental patient who was released and was convinced of the evil of the Jews and ended up shooting Moshe 5 times in the street. This event was a catalyst for the Jews. It created this intense atmosphere of fear, at which point the community set in motion plans to get out. In the process of his trial, they received threats from his tribe, who rallied behind him, saying, if he's convicted, we will see to it that every single Jew in Reda is killed. They received phone calls in the middle of the night. A hand grenade was thrown into one of their courtyards. Ultimately, though, the government did convict him and executed him, but that created this atmosphere of fear that prompted 60 Jews to leave for New York to Muncie and another 10 to go to Israel, 9 of whom were of the same family. Now, this is Moshe's father at his trial. these are his kids that are now living in New York. His father is still in Reda, as far as I've heard, but all of his kids have subsequently left and are now living in Satmar custody. What remains is around 200 Jews left in Reda and the 67 in the capital. The British government granted them refugee status in 2009 following this event. They haven't left mainly because they are anxious to sell their houses at market price. They think that if they leave now, they'll get ripped off on the housing prices, so they stick around. The 67 remain in Sana'a, and the rabbi told me that he's there till the end. And he said, until the people of Yemen say in one voice, we don't want a single Jew here, we will stay here because it's our home. Now, the question that I get most commonly from people is, why do they stay? Why do they stay in a society that is so openly hostile towards them? Well, as simplistic and simple as it may sound, home is home, and the prospect of leaving everything you know, the culture that you grew up in, the language that you speak, and going to something completely new is a daunting prospect, especially when you have grandparents in your family, old people who are obviously not going to integrate or learn the language of a new culture. And even for someone who's of middle age, like the rabbi, moving to New York or moving to Israel is a scary prospect. On top of that, for those in Sana'a, they're given special status. They're the president's guys. He visits them a couple of times a year. The rabbi has the president on speed dial on his cell phone. he's visited by ministers and journalists constantly. Whenever something happens in Israel, they know that they can count on him for a good quote distancing the Jewish religion from Zionism and Zionist movement and the actions of the Israelis. So they like that special status because they know that if they went to Israel or they went to New York, they'd be just more Jews. They wouldn't have that special status. On top of that, they'd be more Jews who didn't even speak the language. It's one thing to move to a new country with 50,000 of your brethren, when the entire community experiences these new things together as a group. But they're going 60 years after the main waves of emigration. It's a different society. Yemeni culture in Israel is barely Yemeni culture. It's become Israeli culture of Yemeni origin. Now, that actually brings me to the next reason why they stay, and that's this fear of losing their culture. All of them have been to Israel. All of them have been to Israel. Many of them have studied in Israel for 2 or 3 years in religious seminaries, and then have gone back to Yemen, some to become teachers in the schools there, and some to be to just live their lives. It's their home, and they're expected to return. Now, when they go back, they tell stories to the community of Yemenite men who don't wear peyote, who don't wear a kippah, who don't wear a beard, who just look like non-Jews. They believe that they've become completely secularized, and they're right. Many of them have. Yemenite culture for many Yemenites in Israel is simply Ofra Chaza and Jachnun. It's not the traditions that they learn in Israel or they learn in Yemen. Because they were so separate a minority in Yemen for so long, what they had was their Judaism. That's what brought them together. And when they were permitted to just be whatever they want in Israel, many of them, you know, they became butcher, baker, candlestick maker. They didn't need to be able to recite Aramaic at every Sabbath. So this belief that they will lose their culture upon emigration is very strong among the community. I heard stories constantly about the half-naked women in Tel Aviv on the beach and all the other corruptions of Israel. Anti-Zionism and the role of anti-Zionist rhetoric in Yemen definitely plays a big role. But even this fear of losing their culture is present for those that think about moving to New York. Well, it's a little bit different because they're afraid that they'll just become Ashkenazi like the Satmars, which is better than just secular like the Israelis, but it's still a point of contention and a point of fear for them. And on top of that, this idea that they are the last, they hold the keys to the temple. This is 2,500 years of continuous Jewish existence in the country, and the burden upon them is if they leave, that's it, the door is closed. There will be no more Jews in Yemen. And so they have this point of pride, and they look at the state that Yemenites in Israel have for them fallen into of secularism, and they realize that if Yemenite culture is to be preserved, the only people that are going to preserve it are those that are left in Yemen. And so they stay for that reason as well. This is something that was reiterated to me over and over and over again, hearing about the glorious and noble history that the people have, and the fact that that history has been largely forgotten or commercialized among those that left. And last, it's simple stubbornness. They want to sell their houses at the market price, and they don't want to get ripped off. And that's why they stay.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Josh Bear for his wonderful presentation tonight. I'm Gina Bellaria, and it's time for the Q&A portion. So if anybody in the audience has any questions you want answered, please write them down. We'll pick them up and get them up here. And we already have a lot of questions. So I want to start. Your first visit to Yemen was prior to the murder, correct?
Correct.
What about your second trip?
After.
So can you talk a little bit about the differences you witnessed, either in tone or just culture itself?
Well, because I wasn't in Raida, where the murder occurred, and that community was the community that was most seriously affected, I didn't see a tremendous amount of change among the Jews in Sana'a. But when I was living in Israel, this is an interesting story. When I went to Riyadh the first time, I stayed with a family known as the Sa'id bin Israel family. We stayed in their house. We ate at their table. After the murder, the first family to emigrate was the same Sa'id bin Israel family. At the time, I was living in Beersheba in an absorption center for new immigrants. And where should they be housed but the very same absorption center about three doors down from me.
Wow.
So we became close during that. It was about 6 months after they left, before I left Israel and went back to Yemen. And he spoke about the belief that he needed to get his family out. It was his house that had the grenade thrown at it, his phone that was called with threats, and he believed that if he was going to protect his family, they needed to get out. In addition, I knew Naharis in Israel. The Nahari clan is a big Yemenite family, and I knew people who were relatives of Moshe and spoke about, I mean, it's different for them because they had gotten out. But I can say that about a week before I left, 12 or 16 Yemenites from Raida arrived at that same absorption center, all of whom had left in the wake of his murder.
I'm so sorry. Lots of questions came up while that answer was being had. I have a question about the assassination. Prior to the assassination, was there anti-Semitism? Was it open? Was it active? Or was it just sort of underlying? And
this is a good question. What I found in Yemen is that Yemeni people are very, very quick to disassociate the Jews that are indigenous residents of Yemen and had been indigenous residents of Yemen for thousands of years. They're aware of the fact that prior to the coming of Islam, there were Jews in Yemen. This is a commonly known fact in Yemen. And they disassociate the Jews that live in Yemen from global Jewry and Zionism. And you hear a lot of rhetoric about the Jews, but the Jews that I met did not feel like it applied to them. And whether or not they were correct is a separate issue. But yes, the answer is I saw a lot of anti-Semitic rhetoric, which I took as par for the course.
Okay. So is that why the president can so openly visit and support this community without drawing the ire of his people?
Yeah, they're seen as his Jews.
Got it. Okay. We have a question from an audience member wanting you to discuss a little bit about the internal, external geopolitics of Yemen and how does that impact the Jewish community there?
Well, obviously that's a question that could fill its own lecture, but how the Jews fit into that? Was that part of the question?
Yeah, how that impacts them.
They have no political designs or power or anything in Yemen, and if it impacts them, it will be it that impacts them and not them that impacts it. It'll simply be because they got caught in the crossfire. Their existence in Yemen at this point is a tiny drop in the bucket of Yemeni problems. And there are a multitude of factors that are affecting the Yemeni opposition, the movements that are currently underway in Yemen to bring a change to the regime that's ruled Yemen since before unification. Jews or Judaism, Zionism has nothing to do with that.
Okay.
It's corruption. It's it's an entirely separate lecture, ultimately.
There's a question from a couple audience members, actually. With such a small Jewish community in Yemen, how do they limit marrying?
Well, first of all, the Jews of Yemen were one of the few Jewish communities in history that allowed polygamy. So to this day, they have multiple wives, and that's acceptable if you can afford it. Mm-hmm. But that's a big issue, mostly because we're talking about, in all of Yemen, six extended families of Jews left. So marriage within the family is not just commonplace, it's a necessity. I will say, though, that when I went to Yemen, they were real anxious to hook me up with a bride.
That's fabulous. On that note, can you tell us a little bit more about the women and the girls in your photos and in Yemen and what sort of relationships, in addition to the polygamy?
That's an interesting question that I'm not entirely qualified to answer, simply because it was very rare that I engaged that segment of the population. My girlfriend Rachel, foreign women in Yemen are often referred to as the third gender, because they're foreigners, they can sit with the men and converse with the men, and because they're women, they can sit and converse with the women. So they can move between the genders in a way that I could never. It would be unthinkable for me to enter the women's quarters and just have a seat and start talking. That would be beyond unacceptable. So what I can say is all of the Jewish girls are literate. Their Jewish education does not extend as far or as deep as the men's do, but they are all literate, and the Jews in Sana'a are literate in both the Hebrew alphabet and the Arabic alphabet as well.
Beyond language and alphabet and all of that, what is the education like? Is there mathematics? Is there, just go beyond?
That's actually a very interesting story. There's a woman from a prominent and well-to-do Yemeni Muslim family who became friends with the rabbi and subsequently the rabbi's extended family. She runs a school, a private school in Yemen. And she went so far as to learn the Hebrew alphabet so that she could write the rabbi's elderly father, who had suffered a stroke, instructions on how to take his medicine in Arabic, but written in Hebrew script. So she took a great interest in this community, and because she had a school, she opened it up for the Jews, the children that were living in Sana'a. So they currently go to two schools. They have religious education at home by one of the community members, the rabbi's uncle. And then they have a secular education of mathematics and history and Arabic language and all the other, where they're in a mixed class of Jews and Muslims.
Mm-hmm. So I want to change gears a little bit. We have a few questions from the audience wanting to know a little bit more about what inspired you to study the Jews in Yemen. You said you put the hook in you, but why? What was it instead of maybe in other parts of the world?
That's a very interesting question. For me, it was about seeing the living, breathing faith of a culture that I had thought had gone extinct. It was a realization that this way of life existed for literally millennia in Yemen in much the same way. And because this community is moribund and it is emigrating slowly, slowly, I felt that I was in a unique position to witness the last pangs, the last existence of the Jews in Yemen. And I think it's a combination of their intensity of education and isolation that really got me. This is a complete cliche, and it's thrown around so much when we're talking about Yemen, but I really did feel as though I had gone back in time to meet a Jewish community that it was essentially a medieval Jewish community in its practice and its history.
Okay, excellent. Are there other diaspora communities around the world, Jewish diaspora communities?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where are they?
There's a small community in Tajikistan. There's a small community in Bukhara, in Uzbekistan. Azerbaijan has a small community of, they call them Mountain Jews or Juhuri, up by the Russian border, across the river from a town called Ruba. It's actually the town is called Kharmazakezebe, I believe, and it's the only 100% Jewish town in the world outside of Israel. It's a very interesting, that's another very interesting culture. They have their own language. It's a dialect of the Tat language, which is in turn an Iranian-based language with elements of Turkic and Slavic linguistic influences. Mountain Jews, Bukharian Jews, Tajik Jews. There's an interesting community in eastern Russia, but none of them are indigenous. That's the community of Birobidzhan.
Birobidzhan,
yeah. But all of them are transplants from Western Russia. Okay. I'm having a hard time thinking of
Africa too.
In Djerba, in Tunisia, absolutely in Morocco, of course.
In Egypt,
There's fewer than 50 people. 7 in Syria. I think the last 3 in Iraq left.
Yeah, there's about 30 in about a little.
Then there's interesting communities in Ethiopia, in Uganda, all with very interesting cultural histories of how they came to be there.
Uganda province in Ethiopia, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of Cochin, yeah. There's still some, I believe. For the most part, now they live in the Negev.
So given all of these communities, I'm not sure if there are commonalities or not. How do they fare with the people around them, their governments?
That really depends on the country that they're in. The Jews of Azerbaijan, the mountain Jews, apparently do very well for themselves. It's an affluent, thriving community. It's not one that's oppressed or second-class citizens in any way. The Moroccan Jews, likewise, I believe, are doing pretty well. The community in Tunisia, I don't know a tremendous amount about their... we'll get to that. I believe they're mostly focused on the island of Djerba.
Yeah.
And Tunis?
Tunis has at least 1,000, and Djerba has...
Well, oh, I didn't realize that it was that large.
Okay. So
when we have finished, if you want to know more about Tunisia and other parts, I can...
Bahrain has about 40. Okay. Yeah. Mostly, they're Persian-speaking Jews, I believe.
Okay. So how have the Yemeni settlers to Israel been accepted by Israeli...
I actually tried to avoid that subject simply because the Yemenite experience in Israel is a tremendously interesting and multifaceted experience, but it's a huge topic to address. Generally speaking, if I had to sum it up in a single sentence, I would say that Jews emigrating from the Middle East and North Africa were treated significantly worse by the European Jews that were living there. They were treated as peasants, as second-class citizens, they were kept in the Ma'barot, it's the refugee camps for years, even after the Ashkenazis had all moved into towns and settlements. There's a lot of issues related to the Yemenite experience of children being kidnapped and their parents being told that they died in childbirth, or only to find out years later through DNA testing that they were in fact just given to Ashkenazi families and raised as Ashkenazis. It's a completely different experience, but I will say that after I left Yemen and went to Israel, I was interested in what happened to Yemenite culture, and I started looking at Yemenite communities and speaking to Yemenite people, and on a very superficial level, it was, food and music, that's what's left.
Wow. What about in the United States, in New York? I was fascinated as you were talking that I'd never heard of this settlement in New York, and I feel like...
Muncie and Kiryas Yoel are some of the very interesting little enclaves in northern, just north of the city, that are almost exclusively Jewish. Yiddish is written on the signs alongside English. That community of Yemenis that has moved in there has been historically very difficult to penetrate, not out of their own reticence, but because of the tight leash or the short leash that the Satmars keep them on. I actually spoke to a guy that I knew in Yemen who had subsequently left Yemen and moved to Muncie, and he told me that he was not happy in Muncie, and he was, if he could, he would go back to Yemen.
We have a question from the audience about your experience in Yemen. You've talked about what you saw, but how were you received during your time there by both the Jewish people and the Muslim community?
I love Yemen. I go back to Yemen in a second. Incredibly open and wonderful people. I'm speaking, of course, of the Muslim community. Absolutely the most hospitable and anxious to meet you, speak to you at every opportunity. Yemenis are, by and large, very, very quick to disassociate the actions of a government from its people. And they I'm not Bush. That's not me. And I was received very, very well in Yemen. I would recommend it if any of you are interested. It's a wonderful place to go. And the Jews, however, took a little bit of convincing that I was, in fact, Jewish. But after about 2 weeks or so, they warmed up, and we were accepted.
Do you think that, this is another question from our audience, wondering, would the Satmar, do you think, prefer to have some Jews remain in Yemen, or would they like to bring everybody back?
That's a really tricky question. I don't understand Satmar mentality that well to answer in a full and complete way, but I would say that preservation of the Yemenite way of life in Yemen is a big priority for the Satmars. And unless that came at the community's physical safety, the cost of their physical safety, I would say that they were anxious to preserve life in Yemen. In fact, when I was there, the guy that I encountered was there to convince them that it's great, you should stay.
Oh, interesting. And I'm wondering, Yemeni Jewish life and Jewish culture, Jewish traditions, how do they differ from what we may know about American Orthodox or Reform Jews? What sort of traditions?
Well, first of all, that distinction doesn't exist.
Okay.
Reform, conservative, Orthodox, that's a Western phenomenon. The Jews of Yemen were simply, they were Jews or they weren't Jews, and that's all there was. The Jewish experience, there's a lot of different liturgical, ritual aspects that are different from Ashkenazi Jewry. But I would say that, by and large, the Jewish experience in Yemen, especially in the medieval period, mimicked that of the European Jewish experience, in that they were separate little enclaves of Jews, and there were benevolent leaders and there were hostile leaders, and sometimes times were bad and sometimes times were good. And but on a purely religious level, obviously the keeping of the Targum, which I mentioned, the Aramaic, their recitation of the Torah was unique and very beautiful, interesting, rapid staccato recitation on Saturday. I actually have some recordings of it that I made when I was there. I'm not an expert in Yemenite religious practice, but on the surface, at least, it was markedly different.
Interesting. So as for the 200 or so Jews left in Yemen, and given your intimate experience with them, what do you see happening from this point forward?
A lot of that depends on the outcome of the political instability and uprising that's currently going on. No one can say who's going to come out on top of that. I would say that if the Jews have any wits, they would take the offers that they've been extended to get out and take it. Because, like I mentioned, getting caught in the crossfire, that's a very easy and quick circumstance that could happen to them.
And then I have one more question. Oh, there's someone who's very interested. You talked about Gat. Was this always a very popular tradition in Yemen, or just since they've been able to have a lot of the hours to relax? Gat.
The prevalence of Gat in Yemen is noted by travelers as far back as, I think, the 17th century. So it's been there. It's originally from the Horn of Africa. Mm-hmm. It's present in both Ethiopian and Somali traditions as well. The people that I spoke to about the prevalence of Gat ascertained that the degree that it's at today, where roughly 90% of the population uses it on a regular basis or chews it on a regular basis, is a 20th century phenomenon, and around the turn of the century, its use really ramped up. No one can know for sure. As far as I know, there have been no agricultural studies of Yemen about the use of land and gat chewing. I can say that it's absolutely wreaking havoc on the agriculture of the country, simply because it's cash crop. So if you were growing potatoes and tomatoes, you can get three times as much for gat. But then suddenly they estimate that in 10 to 15 years, 80% of all agricultural agricultural needs of the country will have to come as imports. So they won't be able to grow enough to feed themselves because of the prevalence of the gat. On top of that, it's an incredibly thirsty plant, and Yemen is not a country that is replete with water.
Great.
But so doesn't that also mean that 90% of the people would be stoned from it? I mean, how do they function on an everyday
stoned
basis?
Stoned is an exaggeration, I would say, when talking about gut. Compared to 6 shots of espresso.
Go ahead.
Like a, I'm sorry? I believe I've never chewed cocoa leaves.
But doesn't that supposed to make you lethargic and lazy? And
gut is theoretically a stimulant. I think taxonomically it's a stimulant, but the social effects of it are that you sit around with your friends in a room talking and chatting and chewing. So you're not in an office working and producing.
And I have time. We have time now for one last question for this wonderful presentation. So thank you so much. And I actually wanted to go back and reference the protests going on all over the Middle East. And this may be slightly outside of what you've studied, but are the Jews in Tunisia and Yemen and other countries involved in the protests? Are they engaged with them or outside?
I haven't heard anything. I can say neither. I can. Can't say one way or the other, but I would assume that they view these protests with the degree of skepticism and wariness that they would just as soon stay out of saying one way or the other.
I may comment on this because this is what Jimena monitors what's going on. Right now, first of all, they are absolutely not involved in anything political. They wouldn't dare. They're too afraid, even if they wanted to. There are no Jews left in Libya. The last immigration of Jews, I was on that bus that expelled us, from the country, so to speak. So the Jewish community of Libya is totally extinct. As far as the very few people that are left in Egypt, there were 30, possibly 40 Jews that are left. They left a huge number of very well, very historic synagogues. And one of the things that's happened is that they were very scared that those synagogues may not be protected during the crisis. And some synagogues were protected because they're museums. There are no Jews praying there. And some were not. But none of the Jews were involved in anything. As far as Tunisia is concerned, there was an incident where one of the religious sites had been burnt, and one of the Torahs had been burnt by the mob, but we were supposedly was because they were burning other places as well, and there was a couple of incidents where there were riots and some people said, kill the Jews and that sort of thing. But right now it looks more and more obviously from everything we see that the demonstrations are geared to change the government, and they're not really focusing on their Jews, but if there is a big change, or whether it's in Yemen or in any other country, or whether there is big riots, there's always a fear that Jews would be in the crossfire. So that's basically. So they are very scared, but they are not opening their mouth. They're just, surviving right now.
So on that note, I wanted to thank Josh Bearer, linguist, journalist, and blogger of the site Nomad Out of Time. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Gina Bellaria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thanks.